It may seem like they just finished, but South Florida lawmakers went back to Tallahassee, back to work this week, to the meetings and committees that paved the way for the 2020 lawmaking session. The agenda is broad and it's deep. Dozens of bills already filed. Already, many of them are about guns. Just last session, Florida lawmakers voted in unprecedented gun safety laws as a response to the mass shooting at Douglas High, though an unrelenting series of others since have Floridians even more focused on a fix. And that is where we begin with State Senator Aniteri Flores, Republican leader from Miami, who, after 16 years, will serve her last session because of term limits. Senator, so nice to have you here today. Thanks for coming in. Your last session coming up, long way to go, but I can't even imagine the state legislature without you. That's just
me. Oh, that's very kind.
But, you know, I want to start out with a lot of bills are being filed. This week is the first bill filing week, and a lot of the bills that were filed, 10 of them, have to do with gun law. And before we get into the nitty-gritty of those, I just want to get your take on, is there a difference, a sea change that you see in the legislature regarding gun law this year that you didn't see in years past?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, let's start off by saying that the climate has changed, I would say, dramatically in my time in the legislature. As you mentioned, this is I'm in my last legislative session, so I'll be capping off 16 years of service in the legislature, which is quite some time. But in that time, there's been a big change in the way that we discuss gun issues, gun control, gun violence.
Especially this past session because of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, the massacre and the amazing way those kids went to Tallahassee.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then, you know, you combat that, you not combat, but you rather you add to that tragedies that happen in Dayton, Ohio, in El Paso, Texas. Right. And you realize that, you know, we have to do more. And so we've started that off, at least in the state Senate this year, this week there was a discussion on what causes these mass violent gun attacks. And specifically talking about the issue of white supremacy. Does that play a role? Does racism play a role? And so there was a discussion on that. And I think that based on that, you're going to have a series of bills that'll come out, hopefully with bipartisan support, to talk overall about how to balance your Second Amendment right to protect yourself, but how to balance that with the right that everybody else has to protect themselves as well.
You know, of the 10 bills that were filed, three of them filed by Republicans, seven of them by Democrats, last year after Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, really what had been a very pro-Second Amendment state legislature passed what was unprecedented controls on guns.
Absolutely.
Age 21, ban on bump stocks,
and a red mandatory, mandatory waiting period.
And waiting period and red flag laws.
Exactly. So things that other states are looking at now, we did last year. This was not something that the NRA supported, yet it still had support from Republicans and Democrats.
Okay, well, my question is, one of the bills this year filed by one of your colleagues would undo all of that. What's your take on that?
I would be incredibly surprised and shocked if a bill like that would get any sort of traction. There are still some legislators in parts of the state where their constituencies are different, and the NRA, I would say, has a bit of a stronger hold. And so people can, you know, people file bills all the time. Filing a bill and passing a bill are two very, very different things. I think if we pass gun legislation this year, it will only seek to expand on what we passed after Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, certainly not taking it backwards.
You have, in the past, you have not supported open carry type laws. No open carry in board meetings, no open carry in the classrooms, and that's been a question. Starting October 1st, part of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas law is guardians on campus. The South Florida school districts did not opt into having armed guards on campus in the guardian program or teachers being trained. With your past in as a pro-Second Amendment senator opposed to open carry, what's your thought on teachers being trained to carry in the classroom?
Well, I think that it's not something that our teachers need to be adding to their already very, very full workload. And so when we saw that, you know, we passed that last year allowing teachers, now that it is about to become law, very, very few school districts are going to opt for that opportunity to allow teachers to be part of that guardian program. And that's just a reflection of what I guess I kind of knew was going to happen, which is that teachers don't need that extra burden, that extra responsibility. There are other ways to keep our children safe.
All right. And okay, so we have this much time,
right?
You have this much session and all of those issues. I want to take a big turn now and talk about property insurance.
Yes.
This week, you're on Twitter, and you tweeted out, what I'm not going to verbatim it because I don't remember.
It was a bit sarcastic.
Yeah. What was the verbatim? Do you remember? Why aren't the rates going down? What did we just hear from the insurance commission? You learned something from the insurance commissioner this week, you and your colleagues, that AOB reform, essentially assignment of benefits. I know this is like a technical term, but this is really nitty gritty. Mm-hmm. People are paying high premiums because of insurance fraud, so right. Say the companies.
Right.
The legislature fixed it last year. The governor was all about it. Mm-hmm. And you tweeted out, okay, why aren't rates going down?
I think that's the frustration. And so this week we had the commissioner of insurance testify before a Senate Banking and Insurance Committee and made some rather startling revelations in a public forum, starting with that they never deny an insurance increase. The commissioner actually went out and said there are times where we even negotiate with the insurance companies to essentially make rates higher. He didn't say it in exactly those words, but that was the that was what it sounded like. And then the second startling thing that he said was that in relation to this AOB reform that you referenced, and I know it's technical, but it's important because it is the latest iteration of what the insurance companies have said, this is the reason why rates go up. And so last year, the legislature passed a bill to deal with that fraud. And now the commissioner of insurance came before a legislative committee and said, well, your rates aren't gonna go down. And that's very frustrating.
So let me just headline that again. The insurance companies went to the lawmakers to say, this is, you know, it's fraud and we need your help so that we can lower insurance. The legislature helped the insurance companies and now the insurance companies are raising rates. What's the legislature going to do about that?
Well, hopefully something. You know, I mean, this has been the frustration that I've had for my years is too many times we have had insurance companies say and, you know, come to us and say, please help with this fraudulent issue. Here's what I have proposed in the past, I'll propose it again, and maybe this year it will pass, is that when we do what the insurance companies say, right, for lack of a better term, right, just to condense it, if we're gonna do what insurance companies want us to do, then they have to give us something in return, which is at the very minimum, stabilize rates for a few years. What they really should be doing is lowering rates as a result of the bills that we pass. I think unless you require insurance companies to lower rates, they just aren't going to.
And it's a really complicated thing. There's reinsurance, there's building costs. And I know it's very complicated, but that's something that everyone's going to be really watching the legislature.
Absolutely.
One more quickie thing before I let you go. You sit on the Rules Committee.
Yes.
And the Rules Committee will be the first to get the recommendation of the special master as to whether or not to overturn the suspension of suspended right. Broward Sheriff Scott Israel. Have you heard from the special master yet? And what are your thoughts
yeah.
on?
So I have.
How are you going to vote on that?
I haven't heard it from the special master yet. Obviously, we need to look at the report, and I will be essentially sitting as a juror on the report. So
yes.
I can't publicly make a decision one way or the other right now. But it is something that's going to move forward, and it is. This is the way that the rule of law works for this particular issue, and so we'll have to see what the special master says, and then we'll make a decision based on that.
Anna Terry Flores, in your last session
yes.
as a state senator.
It won't be my last time coming on the show, though.
No,
have me whenever.
No, ma'am, it will not, and we'll keep in touch with you and see how all of these things go. A lot more to talk about with you. Thanks
Absolutely.
So much for being
Thank
in.
Thank you so much.
All right. The call to action for climate change is global this weekend with rallies all over the world and right here in South Florida. The United Nations starts a climate action summit tomorrow. No one needs to convince Floridians of the impact and effects of warming planet. We are on the front lines of that. And now there are some significant plans in the hopper in Tallahassee to address it, aka a series of bills filed by South Florida Senator Jose Javier Rodriguez. He is a Democrat from Miami-Dade, and he is here to get into the details of some of that. And it is great to have you here this morning. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
But before we get into the whole climate change bills that you filed, I really want to send our condolences to you and your family, former Miami Mayor Maurice Ferre, who passed this week. So much has been said about this great visionary, trailblazing yeah. leader, Miami-Dade Commissioner as well. But to your family, he's your wife's grandpa and a great-grandpa to your kids. And I would love to hear, you know, what your family is really remembering about him today.
Well, I want to thank you, and I want to thank everyone who has shared tributes, personal remembrances of Mayor Maurice Ferre. You know, in public life, it is very difficult to summarize his contribution. I think all of us are saying that he's the father of modern Miami, but it doesn't end there. He was very engaged in the status of Puerto Rico, in transportation, in a whole range, in technology, so many issues.
Really and laying the groundwork for what Miami has become and is becoming.
Absolutely. But on a personal note, I mean, I will say that part of his legacy that I think is known, but maybe not as known, Mercedes, his wife of 64 years, they had six children, they had 13 grandchildren, seven great-grandchildren, one more on the way. And I think one of the things that is such a profound and important part of his legacy is with a family that large to be so close-knit is really a testament to the fact that faith and family were really central to the mayor. And so Thursday at the Cathedral, St. Mary's Cathedral, at 10 a.m. There will be a public memorial service. So thank you for mentioning that in your kind words.
That's great, and thank you for sharing that with us. And shall we get down to some business here?
Sure, yeah. Mayor Ferre was always focused on the future, so I think talking about our present and future on climate, I think, is appropriate.
That's a beautiful segue. And the bills that you filed this week in Tallahassee, there's a series of them, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty of that. I guess the big one is making Florida totally 100% renewable energy state by 2050, and that number is, you know, wow, but that's only 30 years away. That's our lifetime right there.
Absolutely. So I think when we talk about climate is not an issue that is separate from everything else. It's an economic issue. It is a moral issue. It's a health issue. And a lot of what we've been talking about here in Florida is dealing with the effects of climate, but we need to tackle the causes as well.
Get in front of it instead of
Try to slow this speeding train down. And a lot of the legislation that I have filed, I'm working with many others. There's more legislation coming. I'm trying to put as much in the hopper, as you say, to move this forward. It is urgent that we do this, not only to take responsibility for our part in the climate, but also because this is not Houston, this is not West Virginia, there are not oil, gas, and coal jobs in Florida. We are a solar state.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. I want to show, when we get a sort of go
rogue
here
for a minute. I'll make you hold the boot, I'm sorry.
the senator took his shoes off for us today, and this is a boot you wear in Tallahassee.
Yes.
Kind of gimmicky, if I could. But sometimes you need gimmicks to get attention. Is that right?
You're absolutely right. It is completely ridiculous to wear rubber rain boots in the legislative session.
And yeah, I was thinking that. Just
no, but to be honest with you, that's the point.
Yeah.
Because it enables me to have conversations with every single one of my colleagues as often as possible about the urgency of climate change. And as ridiculous as it is, the fact is, it's also really ridiculous we have not taken bold action on climate in a long time.
Do you think the bills that you filed, some of them are fairly similar to bills you filed in 2017 and 18 that went nowhere. Do you see a sea change of sorts, a different perspective? I know that the governor is an environmental priority guy. He's shown us that. He appointed the first state chief resiliency officer. Do you see in Tallahassee an attitude shift that may get people behind the bills this time?
Listen, the ingredients are there for significant action this legislative session on climate. First of all, in the state Senate, one of the bills that I filed, we made it through two Senate committees unanimously. The only debate were from Republicans supporting it. We had a broad coalition. What that bill does is it requires sea level rise planning coming with state dollars and infrastructure. That would be transformative in the private sector as well as in the public
sector. It's a jobs issue too.
Yeah. But in addition to that, as we know, The governor has created the position of chief resilience officer. I just met with her. She's great. She's on board. She's on the job. Chief science officer. He has spoken about climate. The future speaker of the House this week spoke about climate, and I think that the biggest challenge we have, to be perfectly honest with you, is the lost decade we had under Governor Scott. The fact that there was hostility to climate for so long means that the bar is unbelievably low. So when the incoming speaker for next year gets praise for just saying climate change, I mean, that's a very low bar. So my hope is that it's much more than just being able to say climate change. We need to act swiftly.
Talk to me a little bit about Senate Bill 288 would specifically clarify what a public utility is. Of course, we know public utilities as FPNL or Duke or Tampa Electric, but there's so many people now, perhaps not enough, but so many people who are employing their own solar in personally. That is a public utility that you now need to make sure is not considered a public utility. Am I reading that right?
Well, one of the biggest obstacles for us, and I've never been timid about the utilities, FPL and others, they have a lock on energy policy in Tallahassee. Until we break that, a lot of the other things we need to do to, for example, promote solar is on hold. And this legislation is a pretty narrow piece of legislation. We actually did get a hearing on it once. It was the only time we got a hearing on it. And what that bill simply says is that you can sell solar energy. If you generate solar energy, you can sell it. This is a specifically narrow version of it, which is geared toward landlords or shopping plazas. And so, for example, if Publix wants to put up solar panels and sell to their tenants, they should be able to do that. That's very narrowly crafted. What we ought to do is open up competition and allow people to generate solar power without having to depend completely on the utilities.
And I'm going to guess that that's going to be a real political issue, because FPNL in the past couple of years has taken steps to really retain its monopoly. And they are growing their own solar, but to retain a monopoly on the solar industry in Florida.
They are, and I think it's interesting because they use those monopoly resources to take out ads and try to convince us that they're putting a lot of solar online. They are not. There are private companies in the state of Florida that have more solar online than FPL does.
You know, I think we're going to really dig into that in the future.
Absolutely.
Because that's a program waiting to happen. But real quickly, talk about tax credit for carbon farming. I read an article that might be more trendy than science, but what does that mean?
Well, listen, that's just one of the series of bills that have to do with energy efficiency and with doing things in our state to incentivize, again, doing our part not to make the climate issue worse, whether it's energy efficiency in our state government, whether it's incentivizing practices in agriculture, and this is just one of them, right? To use practices that take carbon out of the atmosphere. And these are a lot of things that we're, you know, I'm meeting with every state agency I possibly can, many others are as well, to try to see what things we can do.
Well, I hope you will stay in touch with us. I think this is going to be a really big issue for 2020, and we want to be on the front lines of that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in.
Absolutely.
Guns and green cards are among the issues on the plate today for the roundtable this week. Our panel today, introductions first, Melba Pearson is the deputy director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida and a former prosecutor with the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. Mary Lee Cancio is an attorney with her own named firm in Miami, boss, mentor, activist, analyst, and conservative. I got that right off your Twitter feed. Bernadette Norris Weeks is an attorney in Fort Lauderdale with the law firm of Austin Pamies Norris Weeks and founder of the Women of Color Empowerment Institute. Thanks for being here, everybody. There's a lot of like legal brain power here. How did that ever happen? I don't know. You know, I want to start out with a flurry of gun laws that have already been filed, and one of them in particular, filed by a Pensacola Republican, who, Mary Lee, let me start with you on this. In a session after Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, where the needle moved so much, now we're a year and a half removed from that, and this bill would undo all of the unprecedented, though small, relatively speaking, gun laws that Florida enacted in the wake of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. You heard Annie Terry Flores say that she'd be shocked if that happened.
Me
would
too.
Would you be shocked?
I would
really
be absolutely shocked, because there's no appetite for that. I was in favor of that
Even
Parkland
the most
bill.
Conservative members of
I believe
the
I'm a conservative person, a Republican pro-Second Amendment, but I was completely in favor of that Parkland bill that increased the age of 21, the three-day waiting period, eliminating bump stocks. It was a step in the right direction. And people, you know, like my senator that was here just before, Senator Rodriguez, he voted against it because he didn't think he went far enough. I prefer those baby steps in the right direction, and I think most Americans, most voters agree that that was the correct bill post-Parkland.
The red flag laws also are, I mean, Florida has almost become a role model state for red flag laws, Madam former prosecutor. That is almost a no-brainer. And then there's one of the bills expands the red flag laws. And yet there is sort of a ripple of opposition to that.
Yeah, well, from a civil liberties and a civil rights perspective, anything that's going to infringe further upon privacy rights is something that's problematic. What we need to be focusing on is the common threads that we see in these shootings, right? So a lot of times you see people who have a history of xenophobia, hate against women, and they're very open and express troubling views on these issues. And that's who we should be focusing on, not just mining everyone's data and storing it, and who knows who has access to it, how long are you keeping it? So that's not the thing that keeps communities safe. We have to look at the patterns and address those issues as opposed to mining everybody's data, which infringes on all of our privacy rights and has a chilling effect on social media. Because now you're afraid to post anything because you're worried it might be taken out of context, and all of a sudden you're flagged as someone who may be a threat in the future.
There are people that are posting things that even if they're not threats, it's just like feloniously not a good idea to do that too. But in any case, you bring up a really good point on what causes mass shootings and the causes of it. And Bernadette, this week a Senate panel actually heard from legal experts, and it was a really interesting idea floated. And apologies, I don't know who in that panel floated it because I just read about it, was that we should start looking at the patterns of where do mass shootings come from and target those people first. Mm-hmm. As a, the legal mind that you are, how would you even do that?
Well, I'm happy to hear that there is just conversation about it. And just the fact that we're talking about looking beyond saying no, first of all, and we're building on something and we're trying to do it with the data. I think that is we've jumped leaps and bounds from where we were 2 years ago. So hats off to any research and data that would be suggested in order to move us forward.
That's actually one of the couple of bills that were filed is about the research, but the sort of hate aspect of it was a big deal in that panel. That hate
crimes
spurs mass shootings. And actually, if you look at the past recent mass shootings, that looks to be the case. But that's kind of a no-brainer also.
Yeah, I'd like people to go out and buy maybe Andrew Pollack's book. He lost his daughter Meadow in Parkland, and
that came out this week.
Yeah, I pre-ordered, so I already got my copy. But he talks also about how the educational system failed. By the Parkland killer, should have been flagged, should not have been in that school. So there are things that can be done. I mean, I'm happy when I drop off my granddaughter at the public school by University of Miami, and there's a guard at the door. I feel safer dropping
her
off.
So much of that is in hindsight, right?
Yeah, and also, I mean, let's look at the bigger picture here. This past summer, we've had 126 people die from mass shootings in America. And the majority of that was linked to hate. It was somebody who had hate against people of Mexican heritage, somebody else who had hate against women. So that's where your core issue is. And also looking at the rise of white nationalism in this country in the last couple of years, the spike in hate crimes, and also the easy access to assault weapons. I'm a gun owner, okay? So putting that out there.
I hear you talking about right. Sort of two things under the same umbrella. That's, hate crimes, school patterns. We learned a lot post Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. But to your point, yes, that there is research that needs to be done.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, and make data-informed decisions and not make assumptions based on, in this particular neighborhood, these people are much more violent, so let's target that, as opposed to having more counselors in schools to be able to work with students, and if someone's exhibiting issues, give them the proper resources they need so that we can prevent this type of tragedy from happening again.
But I think it's equally a tragedy what happened in Chicago the same weekend that we had the mass shooting in Texas, and all the coverage went to Texas because it was a hate crime, versus all the emergency rooms in Chicago not being able to take any more gunshot victims because it wasn't a hate crime. It was just violence in Chicago, and we don't talk about that. So we have a problem.
No, we talk about it.
Yeah,
It just doesn't make the national news.
As someone in the news business, I will tell you it is very difficult to cover all the shootings and all the different kinds of shootings that we see every day, and that's a whole subject in its own. But